Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Peeling Back Money and Life. I'm Casey Redman, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Mike Dunlop. Mike, how are you doing today?
Hey, Casey, I'm doing great. Always excited to dive in and do another episode with you. Today, we got a fantastic topic lined up that's crucial for anyone looking to take control of their financial future.
Absolutely. And today, the topic is key metrics to review yearly and why those matter. And it's not just about the numbers, and we're going to talk a lot about numbers, but it's also about understanding the how and the why behind these metrics to help you to make informed decisions. Because all this has to do with, you know, when we talk about financial planning, these are just aspects, these are metrics that have to do with financial planning. And the first metric that comes to mind is net worth. And that's like the scoreboard of your financial life. It's kind of like that foundation. It's that big metric that we always want to keep coming back to. And that is calculating your assets minus your liabilities. And this gives you a snapshot of your overall financial health. This is important to track it yearly to see how your wealth is growing and or if there are any areas that do need attention. And for example, you know, I know when we did ours last year in 2023, that our net worth went down just because that's kind of what the markets did versus when we did it this year in 2024, the net worth went up. So it's not necessarily you need to tweak a lot. It just sometimes it depends what the markets are doing at that time. So what are some different ways that we can track our net worth, whether it's tools or strategies, and when and how often can we do this? I like to use a spreadsheet, and that just, you know, listing all the assets and the liabilities on that spreadsheet. You know, assets are like cash in your bank, credit union, maybe it's money market at a brokerage company like Vanguard. Could be all your investments, your Roth IRAs, your traditional IRAs, your 401ks, your 403bs, your real estate, you know, your personal home or if you have other real estate properties, your personal vehicles, and any truly valuable personal belongings that you could make, you know, if you have paintings or valuable jewelry, you know, putting on there. It doesn't need to be every, you know, nickel and dime thing in your home, more the things that you can sell for good value. And then your liabilities is going to be all your debts, your liability, your loans, your mortgages. If you have any credit card debt, if you have any other unpaid bills. And it's important here, you know, whether you use a spreadsheet or whether you use a planning software, for example, we have planning software that we provide for our clients where you go over net worth at least once a year with our clients. We're going to be launching a community here in the next couple months in the spring. And our members will also have a planning software on the community that they can track their net worth there as well. And there's plenty of other ones out there, whether it's free or paid, that you can get your hands on and try out and see what works for you. But a couple of key points I kind of want to go over is I think it's important to pick a date every year. We personally do it every January 1st. So we just got done doing this a couple of days ago. And it only really takes about 10 minutes. You know, you're logging into all your investment accounts. You know, for us, it's stuff at Vanguard. It's my wife's 401k, HSA. And then it's, you know, we use Zillow for our home value. We use NADA. And there's a couple other sites that you can use to calculate what your vehicles are worth. And then on the same spreadsheet, you know, I created like a nice visual graph that can kind of see over time. We've been doing this since 2014. So almost 10 years now, or about 10 years now, that you can see the growth and the progress that you've made over time. And it's kind of cool to see. And doesn't take long. And at the same time, I do this after I do my net worth. I figure out what our asset allocation is at that time. Where is it from the target asset allocation? And we'll dive more into that in a couple topics here. But I just want to kind of mention that only takes a few more minutes. So net worth, asset allocation, less than 15 minutes per year, I can get that done. Mike, would you have anything else to add here?
Net worth. If you don't take anything else away from this podcast today, net worth is probably the one thing that you absolutely want to do. That's going to tell you more than any of the other things. The other topics we're going to talk about are all great, but net worth is key. So moving on, tax planning is really another key critical metric. Reviewing your tax situation annually or yearly, you can identify some opportunities to minimize your tax liability. Whether it's through deductions or credits or other tax saving strategies, It's about keeping more of your hard-earned money in your pocket. And just to be clear, we're not talking about tax evasion or anything illegal like that. It's just legal strategies we can do to plan and have better taxes. One thing that you want to know, one metric that you want to look at every year is, what is your marginal tax rate? You know, your marginal tax rate is the amount of tax that you're going to pay on your next dollar that you make. Understanding that will help you identify potential tax savings through maybe contributing more to your retirement accounts or things like that. The other thing too is, go back and look. You know, not everybody has tax goals, but if you have tax goals, or you'd set them for the prior year, maybe your tax goal was to stay below 20% in effective tax rate. Review what actually happened, right? So you set that goal, you know, and then you maybe forget about it through the course of the year, but go back and see, did you stay in that bracket, or whatever your goal was, how did you measure up to that? And then additionally, you know, we're right at the first of the year, so go ahead and set your goals for this year for your tax bracket. Maybe, you know, maybe again, maybe it's a specific tax bracket, maybe it's a specific dollar amount, and you can do all kinds of things, from contributing to your retirement accounts to gifting to, you know, what we will talk about other things throughout the year, but just go ahead and set some tax goals for this year. Next is retirement savings. Let's not forget about that. You know, if you have a 401k or another retirement account, review your contributions and your investment strategy annually. Is it, you know, it ensures you're on track to retire comfortably. And it's about planning for the future. So as you're looking at planning your investment strategies, you know, asset allocation is one of the big things that Casey will talk about here.
Absolutely. And I just want to kind of point out, you know, we started out with net worth, and we went going to tax planning, retirement savings, and now asset allocation. And this might seem like a lot, but a lot of this you can do all in less than, you know, 20 or even 30, max of 30 minutes at one sitting. Because when you're logged into your investment accounts and you're writing down your net worth, you can see, as Mike was talking about tax planning, where am I contributing at? Is it pre-tax to traditional in your 401k, 403b, for example, or is it post-tax in Roth? And do I need to change that? Along with, now we're going to talk about asset allocation, do I need to change where my money is going investment-wise? So asset allocation refers to the distribution of your investments across different classes. So we're talking about stocks, we're talking about bonds, and we're talking about cash equivalents. And you can talk about real estate as a separate asset class, or some people put that in also with the stock asset class category. So this is a key metric, along, you know, with when we talked about net worth, to review yearly, because it determines the overall risk, and it's a big factor in the overall return profile of your investment portfolio and what you're going to be able to look at over time for a return, you know, over decades. So by strategically allocating your assets, having a target that you can go back to, that's based upon your financial goals, your risk tolerance, and your time horizon, you know, trying to mesh those several factors together. So if you have a long time horizon, and just because somebody is, you know, 60, 70, 80 years old, for example, that doesn't necessarily mean their time horizon is 10, 20, 30 years. It depends what their goals are. Maybe their goals is to pass it along to an organization, which then your time horizon is almost infinite, or maybe it's to pass it on to grandchildren or other people, and then your time horizon is essentially their time horizon. So it could be 50 plus years, depending on who you're passing along to. So age doesn't necessarily always matter, is what I kind of want to make a point there with. So why is it important? It's important for diversification purposes to see where we're at. Again, going back to the stocks, the bonds, the cash, because that's going to affect our overall investment performance. It helps also with risk management. So by diversifying your investments across those different categories, and those are going to change over time, depending on what your goals are and your time horizon, your risk tolerance, and making sure to have enough in those stable asset classes such as bonds and cash that can help cushion that impact of the market downturns, so that your stocks can keep growing and you don't need to withdraw from those, for example, when the market is down, that they can stay in there and get that return over decades. And it's about maximizing the return. So you can see these are kind of dovetailing together here, that if you have a target allocation of, let's say, 80% stocks, 20% bonds, and you're sticking through that through thick and thin, you're going to maximize those returns. And that's about long-term planning, because when we set an asset allocation, it's not just for this week or this month or this year. It's about long-term. It's about decades. And if there's, you know, a little bit of fine tweaking there of going from 80% to 70%, for example, stocks, you know, that's not as extreme of going from 80% stocks to 50% stocks. So what is going to be our long-term plan? And then within that stock category, you're going to have, you know, different classes there too, of U.S. stocks and international stocks, and how are you going to put real estate and small cap, you know, large cap, and all those different categories within there. So how do we review asset allocation? We want to assess risk tolerance, and by risk tolerance, it's about, what are your investment objectives? So what are your goals? You know, is it to amass a certain amount at a certain age? Is it to go to organizations? Is it to go to your heirs? What's your time horizon? Again, that's going to go along with that as well. Is your goal to spend all of it by the end of your life? And we hear that a lot in our practice on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. But also in reality, that often doesn't happen, because people don't normally spend as much, and the portfolio just keeps growing over time. And then, you know, what is your comfort level with the market volatility when assessing your risk tolerance? So how did you react in 08, 09, for example? How did you react during the COVID bubble? How about the tech bubble? Or, you know, one of those that you're probably around for, maybe multiple, and how did you react to those? So that will help as one factor determine that appropriate asset allocation mix. And then go ahead and review that current allocation again, at least yearly. Some people like to do it semi-annually, and then evaluate if you need to rebalance. So for example, you need to have, what is your rule for rebalancing? Is it every January 1 when you do your net worth, that if you have a target asset allocation of 70% stocks, 30% bonds, cash, that you're going to get back to that no matter what? Or are you going to use more of like a threshold method? For example, let's say 10%. So if I'm 70% stocks, I'm not going to worry about it until I'm at 80% stocks or 60% stocks, and I'll just kind of let momentum and the markets kind of take its course. So as we kind of wrap that up, Mike, would you have anything else to add there, help our listeners kind of sum that up before we kind of move on?
Yeah, just asset allocation is really a measure of the risk that you need to take to meet your goals. So just high level, think of it is how much risk do I need to take? And that's going to determine, you know, how much stocks you have to bond. So just keep it high level as much as you can. So once you kind of determine your asset allocation and you get that set, you know, and that may change a few times over your lifetime, like Casey said, but not very often. But then the next metric that you want to measure from year to year is, what are the returns on your investments? You know, everybody likes to look at their portfolio and, you know, oh, my portfolio went up 25% or 30% or whatever. But that's something we need to measure every year. And how we do that, there's a number of ways that we're going to be able to do that, and we'll talk about them. But just being able to measure, you know, is your asset allocation and your returns meeting what you need to meet for your goals? So, you know, understanding that strategy behind your investments and making the adjustments when needed is crucial. So I'll just dive into a couple different ones. And the first one is kind of a standard one that everybody can use. The others kind of get into the weeds and you kind of nerd out on them a little bit, but we'll talk about them. Total return. So total return just measures the overall change in the value of your investment. And that takes into account both capital appreciation, which means how much that stock or bond went up, any income generated by that investment, so that might be dividends. It's calculated by adding the percentage change in value of the investment to the income received from the investment over a specific time. So you look at your portfolio, and at the beginning of the year, it was $1,000. At the end of the year, it was $1,100. That was $100 change divided by the portfolio, which is $1,000. That's a 10% increase. That's your total return. And that's what most people do. And if you don't want to get too carried away, You know, that's the number that I would probably calculate. There's some other ones we can talk about is risk-adjusted return. So what this is it takes into account how much risk you took in relation to what your investments are. It aims to provide a more accurate measure of return by factoring in the volatility and the riskiness of what you're invested in. Common risk-adjusted return measures include like the Sharpe ratio. You may or may not have heard about it. It's a little bit more complex of a formula. You can Google it, but that just tells you how much return you got for the amount of risk that you took. The next one I'll just briefly touch on is inflation-adjusted return. So, you know, not only do we look at our return on our portfolio every year, we have to take into consideration what inflation does to that too, right? So if our portfolio went up by maybe 5%, but inflation went up over 8% like it did last year, you know, maybe our return is not as good as compared to inflation. So just taking a look at that every year. It's calculated by subtracting the inflation rate, and you can get that from government websites, you know, from your nominal return, or you could use your total return. So if you subtract out the inflation rate from what you actually gained in your portfolio, that's your inflation adjusted return. Dividend yield. This is another one. If you're, it measures the income generated by an investment in the form of dividends. You know, stocks pay dividends, you know, relative to what the market price is. So if the market price is 100 and you're paid a dividend of $2 over the course of the year, your dividend yield is 2%. And if you look at this, you know, understanding the history of investing over time, you'll notice that dividend yields have gone down over time, but they're still important to look at. Again, you know, these are all kind of in-depth, nerdy metrics to look at, but they're important, that, you know, to people, depending on how in deep you want to get with it. But just to summarize, the important one would be total return. What's the overall change in your portfolio from year to year? So, Casey, do you want to maybe chat about, you know, budget and actual spending and metrics we can measure there?
Yeah, and before I kind of segue into that, I just want to kind of highlight when you talked about inflation-adjusted return, also known as real return. So when we talk about, let's say, oh, I calculated my return this past year and it was 10%. Well, factoring in inflation, you know, it might only have been a few percent versus when I factored in inflation, you know, 5 years ago, it might have been a real return of 8%. Real return is a huge, huge factor when we want to talk about, and then also, you know, what are your expenses? What are your investments costing you? You know, that's one thing that we will dedicate a whole episode or more on. But I just kind of want to highlight it here. Do you know what your investments are costing you? Are you in low cost index funds? Are you in commission based products? Because that's going to eat away at your real return too, which ultimately matters when you're looking at how to increase your net worth over time. Without further ado, we'll kind of get into budget and actual spending as our next key metric here. So tracking your, I know a lot of people don't like the word budgeting. I prefer the word tracking your spending. Whatever it is, you're doing the same similar thing, whatever word you like to use. But it's all about kind of creating that financial discipline, that financial awareness of where is your money going? And is it going to what you truly value? Because if it's not going to what you truly value, then you're not going to be you're not going to be as happy as you would be otherwise. And there's many different methods, there are many different tools out there, but it's about finding one that you like and that you're able to stick with. So it might be a spreadsheet, that's a free service. It might be Mint, that's another free service. A couple lower cost paid services, our Tiller that uses like spreadsheet, Google Sheets. So if you like that, but it kind of automates things for you, or YNAB is you need a budget, and there's many, many others out there, but just wanted to name a few if you're wondering kind of what some options are out there. But these can bring about areas where you may have become a little bit lax in. So if you're, you know, looking at what you're spending on a monthly basis, and oh man, my eating out bill got really high that month or that week, you know, why was that? Or if it's, you know, a kind of recurring thing, do we need to make an adjustment as a household? And it can help you know, and this is a big one, you know, when we deal with people are who are either in the retirement or near retirement, how much do you spend? Helps you know how much you need. Is your portfolio and your other income able to support what you spend on? And it, this doesn't have to take long. You can only do it once a month if you want to start out. If you haven't done it for a while and you want to start out, you know, doing it once a week. But it's if you use just one credit card, for example, or one debit card, and you're just pulling that statement monthly and tallying it up, or you know, Lilo's, like I said before, Mint, Tiller, YNAB, they kind of do it automatically, so you can look in there. But it's about whoever enters it in, or making sure if you have a spouse that you're both looking at it, so that it both kind of hits home. Because if you don't look at this on a constant basis and reflect on it, it's not going to mean as much to you. Would you have anything else to add there, Mike, before we kind of get on to the next metric?
I don't on budgeting. The next thing that really we want to segue into is credit score. Credit score, measuring that every year is important because it affects your ability to borrow money. And how that affects your ability, you know, it may not mean that you can't borrow money, but it's going to affect the interest rate that you'll receive. And really, your insurance premiums are affected by your credit score as well. Your insurance company checks your credit score and they determine your premium based on your credit worthiness. It tells you a lot about your responsibility. So by checking it annually, you can catch any errors or maybe make any improvements to ensure you have a real strong financial foundation. You know, and this ties back to the budgeting too. Maybe you're not one who has budgeted and, you know, you let things get out of control. You let credit cards roll over and maybe they get late and things like that. Your credit score is going to suffer because of that. So to monitor your credit report, you want to do this like, you know, I mentioned a moment ago, every year, but you can do it more often than that. Every year you have the opportunity to get what's called a free annual credit report. And actually, since COVID happened, this updates more than once a year. But by law, you're entitled to get one free report from each agency. And there's three major credit bureaus. They're Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. You can get one every 12 months. And again, you can get this updates more frequently in the last couple of years. But to get this, go to annualcreditreport.com. And request your reports there. Checking these allows you to review the information and ensure it's accurate, as well as identify any potential errors or fraudulent activity. This will show you maybe somebody opened up a credit account in your name, or maybe there's something out there that you forgot about that you thought you'd closed. It's just a great way to go and measure, you know, and understand where you're at. In addition to monitoring your credit report, that's all the data, you know, that's what's happening in your credit accounts. You can also check your credit score for free using a service like Credit Karma or Credit.com. These online platforms provide access to your credit scores, which is a numerical representation of what your credit worthiness or responsibility is. They offer helpful insights into your credit health, and it can help you track your progress over time. You know, remember, regularly reviewing both your credit report and your credit score is an important step in maintaining a healthy credit profile. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Casey. You want to chat a little bit about emergency funds?
Absolutely. Yeah, let's talk about emergency funds. You know, life can be challenging, as we've discussed in previous episodes, and it can be unpredictable. And so making sure having a solid emergency fund can help alleviate that unnecessary stress in our lives, help provide that financial safety net, that foundation. And reviewing it yearly, or as kind of things come up, if you withdrew on it, to make sure that your current situation is up to speed and you have a solid emergency fund, will provide that peace of mind. You know, so whether it's, you know, unexpected events like a car repair or a job loss, or maybe it's an appliance that breaks down. So many have heard of, you know, how much do I have? How much do I need? The rule of thumb of 3 to 6 months of cash or cash-like equivalents. So here, in the important thing is here, it's liquid. So whether it, you know, it's in a money market fund, it's something that's low risk, it's highly liquid. Money market funds are earning, you know, over 5% right now in many places. But this is The goal is to have quick access to those funds. It's not to get the biggest return, as we kind of talked about with asset allocation, but it's about covering those living expenses, you know, your rent, your mortgage, your utilities, your groceries, your insurance premiums, and those other bills that are absolutely necessary. This doesn't include, you know, vacations or going out to eat that aren't essential, and those can be reduced and are totally cut back if needed. You know, if you were to lose a job and you're off work for a few months, you know, where can you absolutely cut back and where can you absolutely not? So this is, again, worth revisiting and making sure that you have a financial safety net. So if you experience some kind of loss or change in something, that you're able to cover that. And you might want to look at, you know, what are your deductibles on your auto and home insurance and health insurance, that you're able to cover those with your emergency fund as well. If you're not quite there yet, right now it's, you know, suggestion is, where are you? How much do you have right now? Is it 1 month? Is it 1 week? Is it 3 months? Is it 1 year? How much do you have? And then work towards your goal over time. So it's not about beating yourself up. It's about where you're at right now. And let's just make progress. Progress over perfection.
Absolutely. I love that. Progress over perfection. The next metric that we want to look at, Casey, is debt to income ratio. And again, this tells you how much you have that you're borrowing and paying on versus how much you're bringing in. Understanding how much that income goes toward debt is crucial. Again, it impacts your ability to take on new debt, and it's an indicator of your overall financial health. Keeping this ratio in check is a key to financial stability. Lenders, they use this debt to income ratio as an important factor in making their loan decisions. The debt to income ratio is a comparison of the borrower's total monthly debt payments. So if you add up all of your debt, your car, your credit card, your student loans, you know, all of that, to their gross monthly income. Lenders use two different types of debt to income ratios typically. They use what's called a housing ratio, and they use a total debt ratio. In a housing ratio, this is also known in the industry as what's called a front-end ratio. It focuses on a borrower's housing-related expenses, and that includes your mortgage payments, your property taxes, and your insurance. Lenders typically prefer the housing ratio to be below a certain percentage. Normally, it's either like 28 or 30%, as it indicates that, you know, the borrower has sufficient income to cover your costs related to your housing. The total debt ratio, this also can be called the back-end ratio. This considers all of the borrower's monthly debt obligations, and it includes your expenses, your housing expenses, your credit card payments, your student loans, your car loans, all of those things. Lenders generally, you know, they like this number to be below a certain threshold as well, and normally that's about 36 to 43% is what you'll see out there in the industry. And that demonstrates that the borrower has a manageable level of debt in relation to how much income they bring in each month. So by evaluating your debt-to-income ratio, lenders can assess the ability to repay. You know, how responsible are you? You know, a lower debt-to-income ratio suggests that you have a lower level of debt relative to your income. And overall, you know, they're looking at risk. And that lower number means lower risk of defaulting on those loans. So on the other hand, a high debt-to-income ratio may raise concerns about your ability to manage additional debt and make timely payments. So these are things that lenders look at when you go to borrow money from them. So that's important to look at. It's also important for borrowers to understand their debt-to-income ratio and strive to keep it within, you know, those acceptable limits that I talked about or lower. You know, are you okay carrying that, you know, up to the max of the ratio, or, you know, are you morally opposed to debt and want to keep it lower? So maintaining that low debt-to-income can improve your chances of loan approval or more favorable terms. I know, you know, depending on your credit score and, you know, and that looks at your debt to income ratio also, you're going to get different interest rates based on, you know, what your debt to income ratio is. So it just signals financial stability, and it's a responsible debt management tool that we need to look at every month. So Casey?
Absolutely. And it's going to play right into our next topic here of savings rate. You know, if you have a high debt to income ratio, or even if you're on the high threshold of what Mike was talking about with that total debt of, you know, 36%, or the housing ratio of around that 28, 30%, it's going to affect your ability to save and invest. So, you know, I would strive to, know the industry metrics of what they're going to allow and what the lenders are going to allow. But I would always strive to aim lower than that. You know, for example, if the housing ratio is 30%, you know, try not to go over 25%. Or if the total debt is 36%, try not to go over 30%. Because again, that's going to affect your savings rate, which is going to affect potentially your goals or what you're able to spend on that you value. So let's kind of get into it. So your savings rate is how much of your income you're saving rather than spending. Okay, pretty straightforward. But it's a fundamental metric for building wealth and achieving your financial goals, ultimately achieving financial independence. So regularly reviewing this along, you know, with your net worth, with your asset allocation, it's crucially important. How much did you save and invest in 2023? And I almost want to call this the investing rate that you're putting away, because let's just say, I'm saving 20%, but I'm putting it all in the bank and it's earning point whatever, versus another person is investing 20% and their return is 8, 9, 10%. You know, it's a big difference. So we want to make sure that you're saving at least 10%, I would strive to save 20% of your income if you want to achieve financial independence. And that will allow you to do it much quicker. And obviously it depends on, you know, where you're at in your life right now and how much you have stocked away right now. But by doing that, it's going to provide you, to me, with one of the most precious gifts there is: time freedom. You know, a lot of us talk about financial freedom, financial independence, but what those really provide you is time freedom. And that gives you the opportunity to design your life on your terms and pursue the activities and passions that bring you joy and fulfillment. So just imagine for a moment, you know, kind of wave that wand of having that time freedom to spend more time with what you love, whether it's family, your loved ones, friends, maybe it's traveling or pursuing different hobbies. You know, maybe you love your job and you want to stay there and do that, but you still want to, you know, volunteer or travel more. Well, it gives you freedom and flexibility to be able to do that. Or if you don't love it, okay, now I can leave it or go part-time and try these other things out to see kind of what do I like to do? What is my passion? You know, it gives you time to invest in your personal development. If we're not growing, then we're going the other way. We're never just standing still. So pursuing, whether it's further education personally or, you know, exploring new career paths, it just gives you all that time to be able to do that. And that peace of mind that, you know, when you go back to, you know, we talk about emergency fund and just that solid foundation to navigate life's inevitable challenges. Because no matter how much money you have, life is going to throw you inevitable challenges. And this can help to alleviate some of that stress by having that solid foundation underneath you. So again, achieving that, it's a journey. It's going to require planning. It's going to require discipline, saving and investing that savings, patience, and smart, wise investing.
Absolutely. You know, when Casey talks about time freedom, you know, the amount of time once you get these things down is going to take you less than it took for you to listen to this episode today. So it doesn't take a lot of time to measure these things that really are going to free up all the things that we've talked about. As we start to wrap up the episode for today, you know, it's clear that these metrics are like a financial health checkup. You go to the doctor every year to get a health checkup. Well, you should do a financial checkup as well. And that's what these metrics will help you do. They provide you insights needed for you to make informed decisions, adjust your financial strategy if you need to, and ultimately achieve your long-term goals. You know, it's not about the numbers. It's about understanding the story that they tell about your journey that you're on. And you know, what is that journey? You know, you want to make it yours. So with that, thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of Peeling Back Money and Life. And we will catch you next time.
And before we leave, we want to leave everybody with an action item. So reviewing those metrics, put them on your calendar if they're not on your calendar for a recurring day of when you review those. Maybe it's annually, maybe it's semi-annually, maybe it's quarterly. For the tracking spending budget, I would recommend at least monthly. So put them on your calendar, because what does not get on our calendar does not usually get done. So, and lastly, for our disclaimer, this podcast is for educational purposes only as anything that you'd find online. We only give advice to people who we know their personal situation, and without knowing yours, it'd be foolish to provide advice. For advice, consult with the experts you may have in your life, your accountant, your attorney, or financial advisor, essentially the people who know you and your situation personally.